Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. To read of the life of the crusading abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison is to reflect on the nature of history and the legacy of an uncommon man. For if it is vision that makes a man extraordinary, it's courage that makes him effective. Garrison displayed both. He would once remark to his son, "If we do not teach by our lives, we teach in vain." In thought, word, and deed, Garrison sought not only a nation free of slavery's stain, but a society of equality and brotherhood. My guest is Henry Mayer, author of All on Fire, recently published by St. Martin's Press. Henry Mayer, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
I want to start with kind of an overall impression of the book that I gained from reading it in the form of a question. It's certainly a lasting impression of William Lloyd Garrison for me. Would you agree, Henry Mayer, that the foresight of his thought, not simply on emancipation, but on racial equality, and his kind of perfectionist vision of American society, are beliefs so advanced that they'd be uncommon even in our own time, much less his?
Well, that's true. I think he is uncommon in our own time, and which is why I really wanted to write about him, because I think we need to hear this today. I think he was so intense on pressing the logic of ideas to their conclusion that he couldn't stop halfway. This business of being all on fire, having mountains of ice to melt, meant that he just wasn't going to rest with a halfway solution. And so the logic of slavery, the logic of abolition, led to the idea that you had to embrace equality and equal citizenship. And, you know, it's once you drop the barriers of race, once you try to say there's no way you can have a society in which you can maintain these barriers, then the vision can unfold and, I guess, warm you and make you on fire.
Let's talk about the roots of William Lloyd Garrison. It's a very uncommon sense of justice and humanity that he manifests throughout his entire life. I was struck by the fact that he was himself the descendant of indentured servants, that a family that came from Liverpool, I believe, to Canada.
Yes.
Initially, and then down to Massachusetts. To what extent was that history and the very powerful example of his mother in particular an influence on the man who evolved?
Well, you picked the two strongest things, and I'm so glad you caught the resonance of the indenturedness, because it seems to me that having families that came as bound labor is very likely to sensitize you to what this is all about. And of course, they were bound labor, they served their terms, and they were free and got their land and their goods and became prosperous. And that was what was denied people who were in bounds not only for their own lives, but their children's as well. And I also, you know, he was an apprentice. So he knew the restrictions. He was an apprentice as a printer, and he knew the restrictions of any kind of bound labor. And, of course, what happens ultimately is all this whole stream of bound white labor, indentured servants that kind of come into the colonies, and then you have the stream of bound kidnapped labor that comes in from West Africa. And ultimately, it's those two labor systems that are fighting here in Virginia.
Yeah, I know how you phrased that in the book. I thought was very eloquent. That these were two strains that came from the Hebrides and the Hausa.
That's right. Well, I like the little
alliteration
the little assonance
there.
and alliteration. I use it sometimes. My children tell me I overuse it, but sometimes it works. You mentioned his mother. I think he had this kind of, you know, when you talk about vision, he obviously could see things in the big picture. His mother was intensely religious. His father was a sailor and alcoholic who deserted, and he's out of the picture. His mother was very powerful. She was both had skills as a nurse, but she also was a lay preacher, and I found evidence, nobody had seen this before, that she really had conducted revival meetings in Nova Scotia, where they first lived, and then in Newburyport, Massachusetts, where they moved. And I've read her letters, and, you know, she was an enthusiast. She writes in a way she hardly ever punctuates. She just writes, and the biblical phrases, the phrases of hymns, mix in with her own advice and her own meditations to where you actually don't know where a psalm leaves off and Sister Garrison takes over.
Right.
And so he was just steeped in this kind of very fervent piety.
Exactly.
And I use for the part titles of the book his favorite hymn, Awake My Soul, Stretch Every Nerve, and Press With Vigor On. And that that was his mother, and that's what she gave him.
You know, one word that occurs to me as I listen to you, Henry Mayer, and once again also occurred to me as I read the book, is the completeness of this man. I mean, his this abolition, as a powerful motive force in his life, was also just part of the way he wanted life to be. I mean, it seems there's something very sweet about this
there,
man.
There is. I called him when I first started this book, I called him a sweet-faced scold. That the contradiction, you know, that he could harangue, he could and exhort, but he did it. People think that he did it out of anger, and I finally decided that he did it out of love, a sort of broader love for humanity. And, you know, of course, for the people with whom he worked and the human community. He was complete. He was a family man as well as a fanatic, you know, and we have this image. He always played with that. He would stand up, you know, with these little gold glasses glinting and this sweet smile, a very studious, earnest look, and he would stand up before an audience and say, I'm the fanatic Garrison, and they would laugh because, you know, he looked like a choir boy.
Your book brings forth something I'd actually never thought of. The distinctions between abolition, emancipation, immediate abolition, immediate emancipation, and gradualism, colonization, these were all words in play as the country began to debate and talk about this this terrible issue of slavery. There is a moment, a striking moment in the life of William Lloyd Garrison, after he begins to speak out on the issue, write about it, where he, I think on Park Street in Boston, makes a declaration that, if I understood it, moved him from the camp of gradualism or just abolition to immediatism, to having the thing done forthwith, forthrightly, once and immediately. How important was that? How important a moment was that in his life and the cause?
Well, I think it was absolutely crucial that Garrison let go of gradualism and embraced immediatism. And I was realizing that just the other day, actually, that immediatism is important in two senses. Not only does it mean immediate abolition, that we should do it right now, although as a reformer he knew that it was going to take a while for people to embrace that moment, but immediate abolition meant in contrast to gradual abolition. And you know that the northern states that had abolished slavery after the Revolution did so with these kinds of laws that said the children of all right. slaves born after, say, 1800, maybe this is 1790, so they put it off right away, you know, the children of slaves born after 1800 will be free when they are 25 or 28. So the gradual abolition laws pushed abolition down the road 40, 50 years, and then maybe a little more after that. Garrison didn't want any of that. So when he said immediate abolition, he also meant laws that would take effect at once, whenever you did it, which he wanted it to be now, tomorrow. All slaves would be freed right away, not just simply their children. He also wanted to be sure that there was no compensation involved. One of the models for abolition in the British West Indies was compensation to the owners.
Yeah, but that in his mind, I guess, would have legitimized the institution of slavery.
Oh, completely, completely. And so immediatism also meant, although it wasn't spelled out, uncompensated owners, that they really had to, he said, if you inherit stolen property, that doesn't make it legitimate, and you can't be compensated for rightfully returning what, you know, isn't yours.
Well, now, you know, Henry Mayer, in advocating immediatism, and it's impossible in the course of a conversation to project the eloquence of this man, the fire and the passion that he brought to all of his statements on these issues. But when he advocated immediatism, it seemed to me that the ire of the South, who already wasn't pleased with him, must have increased tenfold or a hundredfold or a thousandfold. And he did gain enemies within the abolition camp as well, that is to say, the colonization sector.
Yes, one of the things that I think is hardest for us today to get our heads around is the idea that there was a time in the history of kind of good liberal reform that colonizationism was seen as being on the side of progress.
That would have meant sending the freed slaves back to Africa.
That would have meant freeing slaves and sending them back to Africa. Mm-hmm. One reason why it's so hard for us to get the idea in our heads that this was once a respectable position is because Garrison spent the first half of the 1830s so successfully fighting it and exposing it as a sham that it pretty well lost its credibility,
right?
Although it resurfaces, and as a impulse, and there are some disaffected black people who, in the 1840s and 50s, think, well, maybe we could do better. Mm-hmm. But the majority of black people said, this is where we are, this is where we ought to be, and this is where we deserve our rights. And Garrison exposed that colonization as an implausible, illogical, and immoral mm-hmm. position. And to me, as you stressed in the beginning, it's the fusion of the demand for abolition with the demand and vision and understanding that equal rights is the goal and the desirable end product that makes Garrison so compelling a figure as mm-hmm. a dissenter, because there were plenty of people who wouldn't go for abolition because they couldn't get their heads around citizenship. And he made it, he forced that issue, he forced the fusion of those two issues. And he did it first at Park Street. That's why you're so correct to bring up the Park Street sermon. And, you know, I wish that were anthologized along the Gettysburg Address, because in my view, the Park Street sermon, 1829, July 4th, pretty much he used Jefferson's language and tried to talk about the slaves' grievances in the terms that Jefferson had used for the colonies. And he had this imaginative sympathy that was just extraordinary. And I think it amounts to really rewriting the Declaration of Independence to include African Americans. And that was his message. And he really never deviated from that.
Lots to talk to you about, Henry Mayer. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Henry Mayer, author of All on Fire, recently published by St. Martin's Press. Lest it be misunderstood, Henry Mayer, I think at this point we should probably introduce something about the character of American society at that time, the institution of slavery in this country. There's a phrase that I think I quote directly from the book, someone's comment about the United States of America and its slavery in the 19th century, early 19th century, that it was, quote, the most obdurate slave-holding country in the Americas. Was there a particular virulence and violence about the institution in our society?
Well, you know, this is a question that's perplexed historians for a long time. I'm not sure. Well, Garrison's point would be it's fruitless to debate whether one master was less cruel or more cruel than another, because it's the institution of slavery that's the cruelty, that's the sin. It's not the treatment, it's the condition. What was so striking about our country is partly, you know, the U.S. was in a great period of tumultuous economic growth. So there was a very strong, competitive, money-making ethos. And I know the myth of the grand leisured plantation class exists, but, you know, they were capitalists. They were mm-hmm. moneymakers, and they tried to maximize their investment and their profits, and they had, you know, this especially lucrative, exploitative labor system at hand. So they were part of this commercial culture, and it was certainly not the kind of religious sweet fellowship that Garrison wanted, and in a way, the abolition movement was a challenge to the whole culture of Jacksonian materialist mm-hmm. America. What's interesting about because of the Three-Fifths Clause, the slave states and the slave owners had an enormous sense of power and confidence in their power. In the West Indies, for example, the British West Indies, most of the planters, of course, lived in England. So they were far away from their population. And in the way England was industrializing, the planters were losing sort of share. Their veto power was mm-hmm. shrinking. And also it was easier to abolish slavery in the West Indies by a parliament that was, you know, so many thousands of miles away. But what happened happened in every other country of the world. Well, Haiti, there was a revolution. But in every other, all the other colonial powers, Britain, France, the Dutch, all relinquished control over the colonies, but they had abolished slavery first. Brazil and Cuba did not abolish slavery until after we did, but they did it as part of their own internal revolutions in a systematic legislative fashion. Ours was the only country in which the slaveholders fought it, and eventually took up their own arms in a counter-revolution, really, to be sure that, they would never have to give up their slaves. And so they risked it all on the war.
You know, another aspect of this, though, in addition to the war and its violence, and I think that progression you point out is absolutely apt and correct, but I was also struck by the violence surrounding the issue, so to speak, in places that far from the South.
Yes.
In New York, in Philadelphia,
in Boston.
Citadels of liberalism.
Citadels of liberalism, but citadels of liberalism that was tied up very deeply with the economy of the South. There are instances I found in which you can I saw on the desk of a big cotton manufacturer like Abbott Lawrence, who was struggling against Garrison in Massachusetts as part of the Boston elite. He's lending money to John C. Calhoun and President Polk for it to finance new plantations. Emerson said the union's bound together by cotton thread. Senator Sumner of Massachusetts talked about the Lords of the Lash and the Lords of the Loom in alliance. So we're talking about a national economy that had a lot invested in slavery, and so therefore a lot of people in the North had a lot invested in keeping the matter quiet. And this was the big issue that Garrison faced. And I think the reason he was so flamboyant about the Constitution and so daring in saying that it's a covenant with death and so daring in saying that the Union is fatally and morally compromised is because his opposition was saying, well, even if you're right that slavery is wrong, and we understand that, obviously it's wrong, but it's a terrible problem. We can't solve it, one, because of their racist assumptions that black people couldn't be citizens. The other reason they say we can't solve it is because we're bound in this Union. And they kept using the word comity, the kind of peaceful relations and mutual obligations of the states to each other. And this is what Calhoun and the other Southern leaders kept hammering on them, that they were saying their Northern political counterparts were, in effect, being treasonable to entertain any thoughts of anything that would disrupt the Union. And there was that threat of disruption that they played against the abolition demand for a moral consistency.
Well, if that were not enough for society to contend with, all this is also going on in an era of expansion.
That's exactly right. And expansion is what puts the fat in the fire, really, because then you have all this juicy new territory, and it's really which side is going to control it. And what happens is that, and this is kind of, actually, it's sort of tragic for Garrison, because as the issue becomes territorial, the difference between a kind of sectional morality of free soil and a sort of absolutist abolitionist Christian critique becomes harder to reconcile. That people are seeing it, and yes, they're taking the free soil part of it, but not the moral part of it.
Right. Complications upon mount upon complications in this period, and we move fatefully in the direction of the Civil War, and the book introduces, as history did at that point, the figure of John Brown. What does that represent to William Lloyd Garrison, when John Brown, with his fire and his passion and his commitment to abolition, but abolition to be gained through violence, through confrontation, and this nation moving to war, is Garrison vindicated, depressed? Is his vision betrayed? Has it
A little of all. It was a very complicated situation for Garrison. That whole problem of violence was one that dogged him all along. He was a pacifist. In the first year of the Liberator, Nat Turner's revolt had posed the same problem that John Brown poses, in which everybody gets all upset at this audacious physical resistance on behalf of slaves. And Garrison says he does not endorse physical resistance, but it's the consistency he wants. He says, if you, white society, can applaud George Washington and say that George Washington has a right to raise the sword on behalf of freedom and liberation, then you can't say Annette Turner doesn't have the same right on behalf of the same goals. So as the John Brown stuff develops, Garrison literally preaches in a church, an extraordinary sermon on saying, blood may be shed, but let it never be shed through counsel of mine. And he always counseled this sort of soul force as opposed to physical force. But when it happened, then, you know, he couldn't not defend John Brown without siding with the wrong people. So he got boxed in by John Brown. And then, of course, the complexity and the failures of John Brown's actual raid were completely swept away when Virginia executed him and he became a martyr. And the martyrdom, of course, was something Garrison did understand. He'd been nearly lynched himself in Boston in 1835 in a mob, this northern violence you mentioned earlier. And he could make the symbol of John Brown work for his kind of moral reformation, but it didn't last, because when that just set off another spiral of resistance and counter-resistance, and when the war came out, Garrison was really stuck, and he ultimately had to give up or set aside his pacifistic creed, his beliefs, because he couldn't not support the war if it were to be a war for abolition. And so he devoted his energy to making it the war a war against slavery and not a war to just preserve the Union.
And in Abraham Lincoln's fateful words, and the war came.
And the war came, yes.
There was always a tension in my mind in the life of William Lloyd Garrison between his pacifism and his commitment to social revolution. It just seemed to me that there was, in the context of American society, those two things had to be, as I say, a very tense kind of
Well, I think you put your finger on it in the context of American society. And in some ways, you can say that our history did him in. Our culture, our general predisposition to settle things violently rather than through negotiation. We can negotiate the material problems, but we don't seem to be able to negotiate the spiritual problems, or our political system can't. And so I think, really... You know, violence is American as apple pie. It was apple pie that did him in, because we just went. We're too frustrated and impatient, and we went to that solution. But Garrison, I'm calling it pacifism here. But I think that what he meant by that, and the way he elaborated it as theory, is very close to what we understand Gandhi and Dr. King to have been talking about in the 20th century. This is a kind of exercise of soul force. So it's not, I mean, yes, the meek will inherit the earth, but the meek will endure such abuse as to shame the oppressors into giving up their rule. And by their suffering will expose the roots of the evil, the institutions that are corrupt, and so on. So it was pacifistic, but it wasn't passive. And if we understand nonviolence, we can use that term. His terms were different, but the kind of creative nonviolence and civil disobedience that was practiced in the civil rights movement is kind of, he didn't practice, there weren't sit-ins and stuff. They couldn't, the mob was too strong. But the kind of moral witnessing, I guess you'd call it, that they engaged in was their preferred way. And of course, once you get into this violent situation, that's, doesn't work.
I'm glad you said all that you have just said, because I don't have it before me at the moment, but I do have it in my mind. I remember writing down at one point as I read the book that this man wanted to accomplish a transformation of American society through the mechanism of shame, of making
yes.
people feel
very
ashamed
well put.
Of what they had done.
Or yes. But with the shame, I think always, You know this is true in just dealing in your own family life, shame has got to be accompanied by some vision of a better way to act. And I think he did try to promulgate, you know, this vision of a peaceful and egalitarian society that lay over there if we could just get to it.
Right. Well, Henry Mayer, I think we come now at the conclusion of our conversation logically to putting a judgment on this man's legacy and meaning for our time. I was struck by lots of things in this context. I mean, one that leapt off the page at me was that he had, and this I thought very contemporary, an interest in social reform as affected by technological change. I mean, that seems to me, I guess that's true of every age, but that's certainly true of our age now. It's something that I think he probably gained as he witnessed American society and other societies being changed by the Industrial Revolution. He certainly had a commitment to justice issues and to human rights, as we've discussed. With that in mind and other things as well, what makes him relevant for our time? What makes this book important for this day?
Well, what makes him relevant for our time is, I think, the purity of his egalitarian vision that takes us beyond race is one that appeals very much to me personally, and I think it's the direction. It's so hard to believe that somebody like Garrison could actually imagine a multiracial society in 1830, but that's certainly what his vision is, and I think it's the direction that I want our society to go, and so that's why I think the book is relevant. The other part of it is, I think it's terribly important in getting there that we know where we came from, and that we know where we came from both. And some of the stuff in here is pretty hard to take in terms of the racism that's revealed in the North, the antagonism of society. But it also, we know that some people at least thought differently and had the courage to act on their beliefs. And so I think there's an inspiration here for us in knowing that if you will engage the issue, if you don't run from it, if you face up to it and engage in some kind of productive conflict, maybe things will happen. Now, again, there's a cautionary tale here because this spirals into violence and we get an abolition that is compromised almost from the beginning by the fact that it wasn't a spiritual transformation. It was a wartime necessity. And so the Reconstruction impulse, you know, wears out, the war fervor dies, people go back to business as usual, and the losers are the newly emancipated slaves who lose the protective structure that the federal government had tried to put in place. But I think that this spectacle of a society being forced to cope with a profoundly moral and defining issue for itself is something that we can understand and take inspiration from.
Henry Mayer, thank you very much for being with us today on Dialogue. I think you have written a very important book.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Henry Mayer, author of All on Fire, recently published by St. Martin's Press. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Joaquin Soler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.